And I'm trucking on, I'm trucking on. Well, I'll move her on down the line. Another time will do me fine. I'm trucking on.
Howdy, friends, and welcome to Trucking On. I'm your host, Ward Richmond. I really appreciate you tuning in today, and I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Truckin' On. Today, I had the pleasure of sitting down with my good friend, John Altshuler. I've known John now, I don't know, how long? 22 years, 20, 24 years, something like that. Let's just say a quarter of a century. And I've always admired him since the time I began working in the commercial real estate industry as an intern. And we discussed that when I first met him, all the way till today when we get together at this point in time. I don't even know if we've ever really worked on a deal together in the last decade plus, but we get together and have lunch at least once a year or so and catch up. And I've always looked up to him, and now we've become great friends. So lucky me. And lucky you, because now you get to get a glimpse inside the life and the times of John Altshuler. Let's go. John Altshuler, what's up, brother?
All right, buddy. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to Truckin' On.
It's fun to be here.
It's my fairly new podcast.
It's impressive.
We're in the second month of dropping the content, but I think I've recorded the first one over Thanksgiving weekend.
That's good. So I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. You are actually one of the first people I remember meeting in the commercial real estate business when I was an intern at the Staubach Company.
Okay.
Do you remember the story? I know I've told it to you.
I know you told me.
But yeah, I was interning for the tenant rep. You know, they're all tenant rep there. Yeah. So I was just doing market surveys for them and calling and verifying information. And I think even though I was an intern and a sophomore in college, I've tried to carry myself like the regular brokers. And I think you thought I was a new tenant rep broker at Staubach Company, and you were a young hustler. So, I mean, I don't know, you're a little older than me, but this was 1998.
So I was at Crow.
Yeah. Okay. You're at Trammell Crow. And, I mean, when did you start working there?
95.
Yeah, so you're like 3 years in the business, basically. But you were like, hey, let me just come down and I'm going to bring you all the information on this building to you in person, and like drove from your office to the Staubach Company, which that would be downtown to LBJ and Hillcrest. Yeah. And you met me in the lobby and you were like so fired up to like meet the new tenant rep guy that's probably like your peer, and you get the sophomore intern, and I could just tell the look in your eyes, just like
deflated pretty quick.
Oh gosh. Nice to meet you too. I'll talk to you later. And got out of there. It was pretty funny.
You always like, you know, the Staubach group, you always try to do whatever you could to create any kind of advantage into that firm. And all the senior people at Crow already knew all the senior people at Staubach. So I'm sure I thought, hey, here's a young person. I need to cover this young person. Cause
Staubach was just such a dominating force then.
Totally.
In the market. And it was awesome working there. It was one of my favorite jobs I've ever had. I worked there for the summer of 98, and they did not invite me back.
How did you get the job?
Nepotism.
Okay. Connection.
My dad was on like the Dallas Leadership Council or something with Alicia Ragusa.
Yeah.
Alicia Holt back then.
Oh, yeah.
And so that worked out. They've put me through it to get a job there. I had to like write a essay on net present value, which I didn't know what that was when she asked me to do that. I had to Google it.
There was no Google.
Barely. I think it just was invented. I Yahooed it. But I got in there, and then I was playing in my band, so I was very focused on that more so than real estate. I enjoyed the internship, but I was playing five nights a week. So I was playing at 8 hours every Tuesday until like you know, we'd play till 2 a.m. I'd get home at 4 and I'd be there at 8:30 a.m. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I talked about this with Brant Landry because he started working there. He probably took the job that I would have got had I not screwed up my internship. Mm-hmm. But they all liked me. They'd come watch my show and everything. That's probably why I didn't get fired, but that's a miracle. Fun working there. Rogers walking down this hallway and just the whole vibe was great. And anyway, that's when I met you. So I remember just knowing, like, of all the leasing agents that I called, I remembered you because you were hustling, man. So I like to start out by hearing about, like, ages 12 to 22, which is basically leading up to that time when I met you. So tell me about yourself and how those years may have impacted you.
Sure. I grew up in Far North Dallas, Campbell and Coit, went to Pierce High School. So 12 to 22, I think I thought of myself as an athlete and a student and a worker. Athletics, I was real big into basketball, football, baseball. In high school, I played just basketball and I spent all my time playing basketball, practicing the whole thing. My parents were real demanding of my grades, so I considered myself a student. And I was working mowing lawns, and I probably had 10 or 15 lawns that I would mow. And I just remember, relative to my peers, like having money and like saving money and having the passbook and going to Bright Bank and depositing checks and getting the interest tallied onto it.
That's a lot of lawns to mow.
It was a lot. we were busy. It was me and my brother would help a little bit, and it was just fun to get the responsibility and be, you know, be in charge of doing that.
You have one brother?
I do. He's younger, four years younger.
And, that's hard working. So yeah, I mowed our lawn when I was grounded and that was pain just doing one.
Yeah, no, we did 15. So then I went to SMU and was there 4 years, graduated, did the fraternity, met my wife, made good grades.
What fraternity?
Fiji.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. I was with Fiji yesterday, just playing golf with one of my buddies yesterday.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Did you try to play basketball at SMU?
I didn't. I was good, but not that good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How tall are you?
I say I'm 6'4", but I'm probably 6'2".
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
I'm taller than you, though. I'm certain of that.
Yeah.
I paid attention outside a second ago.
I don't know. I slouch to make people feel taller.
I felt 2 inches taller.
Did you?
Maybe I'm 6'6".
I'm barefoot too.
Okay. I'm wearing shoes.
Yeah. You're wearing platform shoes, clearly, two-inch platforms. So anyway, I digress. Did you meet your wife freshman year?
I did.
Really?
Seriously.
Did you start dating right then?
We did.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So you've been through a lot together.
Yeah.
And then what did you do when you got out of SMU?
So I graduated with no job. And
that's surprising to me. Was that intentional?
Not at all. I mean, I went 0 for 16 on campus with the on-campus interviews. Looking back, I wasn't prepared. I thought it was going to be easy. And I just didn't perform. And so I graduated with no job. And my parents, I think, were pretty disappointed. And my dad immediately started setting me up with some introductions to some of his friends here in town. And so I networked with those doors he opened and was able to land a job at a small apartment property manager and worked there for a year. Then I met the guys at Crow and went to work for Crow.
How'd you meet the guys at Crow? Did you start going to NatCar or doing things like that?
I met them through some SMU connections. A woman named Susan Allen, who's now married to Daniel Worrell, the team doctor for the Mavericks. She was at Crow Holdings and she said, "Hey, there's a job open at Trammell Crow Dallas Fort Worth. I think you'd be a good fit for. You should go meet some of these folks." And I'd actually met Mike McVean before, just through some, I was just calling on people I read in that DBJ heavy hitters list. And I met like 15 or 20 people probably.
I loved when that publication used to come out.
It felt for real.
Yeah.
Like they were kind of really figuring out the numbers and you felt like who was number four was number four and who was number 12 was number 12.
They had great profiles on everyone. Yeah. They were creative. Uh-huh. I wish they still did it.
Yeah.
And now they do. Now kind of the replacement is, what is it? DCO Power Brokers.
And that's reported by firms. Like, hey, here's our top three or our top five.
Yeah. And And then it's just a list of alphabetical order. Right. And then maybe they pick like one from each category to put up there. But the heavy hitters, I'm sure I still have it somewhere because I used to save them every year and read it because I wanted to be on that list.
Yeah. So when I got out of college, I went through that list and just started calling the people at the top saying, hey, can I come meet with you? And so I had a bunch of good meetings and I met McVean in that fashion. Actually, I think I'd called on Chuck Anderson, who was running Crow Dallas Fort Worth, and said, can I come meet with you? He said, no, but you can meet with McVean. And so I met with McVean, had a good conversation. And then 3 months later, Susan Allen called me and said, hey, McVean's trying to hire somebody. You should check back in with him.
Yeah.
So I got the job that way.
Cold calling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I tried to actually, I interviewed with Trammell Crow and did not get hired coming out of Brown. And
Which office?
I worked for Faubert coming out of Brown at the Dallas office.
Okay.
You would have been in business school then, I think. That was 2000.
I was hiring no one at Crow.
No, you weren't. But I figured they would like have me meet with somebody.
I met
with younger folks and all of that. It was not really what I wanted to do. It was what I felt like I needed to be doing and what my parents wanted me to do.
Right.
It seemed like, and I've interned at Staubach and Cushman and like, okay, I'll go into commercial real estate in Dallas. And I talked to Alicia, I remember, to try to go to the Staubach company again. She's like, I think you'd be great if you wanted to do this, but you want to go play in your band. So go do that. And she was right. But I was able to fool Todd Faubert and Rick Curry post-college into hiring me. And which was incredible training. It was 2.5 years while I sought my record deal.
That's right.
But how was... The interview process was pretty intimidating for me at Trammell Crow. How was the, did they have a good training program in place there or how did that work?
It was great in the sense that it wasn't like a formal training program, but it's this open floor and there's Mike McVean, Lee Bellin, Chuck Anderson, Pryor Blackwell, Tony Long, Tony Click, T.D. Briggs.
Legends.
Like, yeah, legends. Like, I don't want to, I'm leaving some people off.
But keep,
like,
say, keep naming them.
Talking I mean, for hours.
It's crazy.
Yeah, just like a really all-star cast of people. And for me, it was a matter of just watching how people worked and trying the best I could to adapt as many of the styles or many of the practices that I was seeing be so successful into my own method of operating.
So I've never worked in an open floor layout before. I'm very lone wolf work environment.
You'd be terrible in the open office.
You're in my office right now.
Right.
I like a big open office with just me in it.
Yeah, right. I can imagine you being very distracted in our open office environment.
And for those that can't see the non-existent video of this podcast, we're at my house. So that's where I typically work, or hotel rooms and airplanes.
Yeah.
And I dig that. And I don't know, that's always been my deal, but I guess if you start in that environment, it's different too. And you saw the great value. I understand the value that's there, but what was that like walking into that environment? Did you love it? Was it high energy?
Like, yeah, it was real intense. It was high energy. Like I'd watch Pryor and Chuck and just always noticed how fast they walked. Like their pace was always really fast. And I remember being in the office at 6:30 at night and Pryor was at his desk and his assistant was sitting in a chair next to his desk. And he was, you know, on his desk writing letters and she was handing them envelopes and the next card. And just the discipline and the effort was just real pronounced.
That's where you got your handwriting of the letters.
My mom taught me to do it. She always emphasized the thank you notes. And then Pryor kind of taught me the importance of the affirmation note. Just like the good job.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. So he was just constantly cranking them out.
He was.
Yeah. Well, as you do.
A lot of people there were doing the same thing.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. So you got all of that, those amazing people around you. Then you, how many years were you there?
I was there almost 5 years and I went to business school, University of California for 2.
What made you decide to do that? Did you want a break from the commercial real estate? Or
I think I did. I'd always had the goal to go to business school.
A lot of the Trammell Crow guys went to business school too, right?
They did.
A lot of them had
MBAs. I was raised by my dad. He went to Harvard Business School and he'd always kind of raised me as a young kid to think about doing great in high school, going to the best college you can, get the best transcript you can in college, go to the best business school you can. So it was always a path that I had contemplated and envisioned being on. And so in 99, my wife's mother had passed away a year previously. And it just felt like I was 26, turning 27. It was that window of time that I had to go to school. I felt like it would be good for us to switch locations just because of the grief she was going through with her mother passing away. Right. Like changing places
that's,
might be
that's
good.
Young to lose your...
It's hard.
Your parent hard. That age. Thankfully, both of mine are still alive.
Yeah,
but at that age, I can't even imagine.
It was hard. So we decided to go to California and I got into Berkeley and it was fun. A lot of fun.
I bet. Yeah. That's a cool time to go up there with all of the tech boom going on.
I saw the boom and the bust in NASDAQ.
Yeah. I guess you saw both.
Yeah.
And I know you have friends all over mm-hmm. just from being Instagram friends with you from going to Berkeley, right?
Yeah, right.
So that had to be awesome. I went to Brown, so it's a similar type, like international environment, probably more so than a Texas school.
Yeah.
Right?
It's where I picked up my first set of international friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same. And then like, what was Berkeley like? Do you go to school all the time or
no, business school was a breeze in terms of it's not that demanding scholastically.
Did you work still at all?
I didn't. Lori worked in the city for Williams Sonoma.
Okay.
Like they had their corporate office there.
Yeah.
So she was working and I was just student life and it's pretty simple, pretty easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's how long? 2 years?
21 months.
21 months.
Yeah. 3 months in New York City for an internship.
Goldman Sachs?
Goldman Sachs.
I knew that.
Yeah.
And then you decided not to continue at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah. I don't think they were upset to hear me decide I didn't want to do that, but it wasn't for me.
Yeah. And then came back to Dallas to lease office space.
Yeah. I joined Stream out of business school and was leasing office space.
Did you think about going back to Trammell Crow or you like the entrepreneurial vibe of Stream?
I did both. I did think about going back.
They're both entrepreneurial, yeah. So it's not.
I thought about back to work at Crow. I remember one of my classmates at Berkeley telling me, man, like, you're telling me that you came out here for 21 months to go to business school and you're going to go back and do the exact same thing you were doing before. That's crazy. And I remember over Thanksgiving being at my house with my parents and picking up the newspaper. And at that point, Steve Brown had a Friday column in the morning news and he profiled like six different things, and two or three of those six things were deals that Stream was working on or had closed. It's like, man, these guys are really on top of it. They're leading the market. This is where I need to be. And so I decided to go to work Stream.
How did Stream start? Do you remember?
Yeah, I was a Crow. So I guess Stream started in 96 with Lee and Mike leaving Crow. And just, I remember being at Crow, it was just like, you got to be kidding me. These guys are leaving. Like, how is this possible? And I think that they just decided, hey, we want to go do it on our own. And so they did. And this built it up very quickly. But like deal by deal, like to watch, kind of watch them outside looking in, it was impressive how they kind of methodically just put pieces together with people, deals together with buildings and grew it and then just took off like a rocket ship.
Did they just start on the service side or did they start more on the principal side?
I would say they started more on the principal side, like buying a couple things, then getting hired to do some third-party work, and then really growing the third-party platform, buying more buildings. That's the way it looked.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was 96 to 99. I showed up in 99.
Now, I mean, they're such a beast of an operation today. Mm-hmm. I like the research reports probably better than most other research reports. I don't know if you ever read them,
but
they're great to read. They post them right on LinkedIn. Thanks, Stream team. Always appreciate that. Okay, so then you're at Stream.
Yeah.
You rose up the ranks. Mm-hmm. What was your title when you started there?
Vice president.
Yeah, it was.
Uh-huh.
And then you eventually became the president.
President.
And you were running a team. Kind of, that was a legendary office leasing team.
We were good, yeah.
I did a short stint at Cushman & Wakefield with Mike Wyatt during that time.
Boy. He's good.
He's so good. I learned so much. And that was when you guys were like leasing Rosewood Court and it was being built.
Oh, that was great.
So it's like 2007, I think, around there. And that was the next time I saw you since the Staubach Company was on a tour. We were repping, I think, UBS back then.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I was just like a year and a half back in the business after a 4-year hiatus.
Did UBS stay at the Crescent? or moved to the Crescent?
I think they just stayed wherever they were.
Yeah, because they didn't move to our building.
We didn't do a deal. I didn't get paid, at least while I was there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I wasn't there very long. So I wanted to go be on my own and do industrial. So, but love Mike Wyatt. I got to get him the Stallion, as he likes to call himself, on this podcast.
I was unaware of that. You need to have the Stallion on the podcast.
Oh, yeah. We've got to get the Stallion on Trucking On. But anyway, so you started as a vice president, but then you moved into like management. So how did that transition work and building that team?
How did it work?
And how many years was that? I'm trying to.
Yes, so I got there in 2001 and kind of got put into a leadership role. I got put into a leadership role into 2003, into 2004. And it's just, I think it was just a case of there was an opportunity to take a leadership position, and it was natural to do it.
So many people, that's how Stream works, is that the very talented brokers move into management.
Right.
So I assume that it pays differently than like the way most global real estate firms handle management is like a whole separate group. Like not very many managers, I mean, they might've used to been brokers, I don't know. Like, but I assume it works differently there, where you're incentivized more to be a manager at a Stream than I think you are at, say, I'm not going to name names, but right.
I don't know how any of these firms pay people. I know how I was paid, and I had an incentive to grow my business.
Yeah.
Via go win more assignments, go get more people, help them be successful. And I was getting paid a percentage of the aggregate growth of the business.
Yeah.
So I had the incentive to really go max down.
Yeah. And you hired great people back then.
Bunch of good people.
And did like amazing marketing.
Yeah, that was fun.
I remember the Tommy Gunn Nelson marketing. He'll probably never be,
Which one do you remember though? Like there was two.
There's one like with him, like there's like Tommy Gunn. I feel like there's one with him swimming or something.
Yeah, there's one with him swimming.
I vaguely remember.
There's one with him wearing a white suit. Those were our ideas.
Yeah. That was such great marketing. I forget all the people that worked there because not many of them are in the real estate business anymore.
What's interesting though is that, like, Preston Young now runs the Houston office for Stream. Probably does more than that. Kyle Luby runs DC. Ben Hott runs Atlanta.
Yeah, I remember him.
I'm going to see him in March in Atlanta.
Yeah, he opened up the Atlanta office, right? I remember he was just a stellar leasing agent.
Yeah,
in person. That's cool. And then you made it all the way to the top and to the president of the division, I guess, or the office division.
I think president of the Dallas office was my title.
President of the Dallas office. Yeah. And then you decided to go start your own deal.
Yeah.
Was that exciting?
It was. It was scary. It was exciting. It was exhilarating. All those things.
How long did you think about doing that?
You know, probably most of my life. When I was 21, my dad wrote me a 5 or 6 page letter when I was graduating from SMU. And it was just bullet point, just like some life observations, some life guidance, some career observations of his own, some career guidance. And one of those things he had suggested to me was, hey, you should start your own business. And he kind of explained his theory on it, and he thought you should do it in your 20s. But anyway, I was 37.
Yeah.
I'd always known I wanted to try to do that, and I decided to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. I think about it. You know, I always have. I go back and forth.
You're the vice chairman.
I'm the vice chairman. Thanks. I just got that.
Yeah, I got an email about that last week.
Yeah. It's a new title within Colliers. Okay. So,
I've known it as a CBRE title.
Yeah.
Like, and I know their vice chairmen are the highest in my mind. Like, those are the top professionals in our industry.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to see you guys using the same title.
Yeah. It's a new threshold. So executive vice president was the highest and I achieved that. And then this vice chairman title was created and I found out like, what do you have to do to become a vice chairman? And you have to hit, there's production that you have to hit. And And then obviously just like being a leader within the company and tenure and all of that. So I've been at Colliers now for 11 years. And I mean, I've thought about it because I'm super entrepreneurial, but I feel like I have my own company today. Like we have our own team and we work all over North America and we partner with people. And but Colliers provides a lot of value. Whereas if I were to start my own company, I would not want to go hire like a whole bunch of brokers and create like a international company. I don't have the bandwidth or desire to take all of that on. So my business is North American wide. So we worked in 67 different markets. Yeah. And I know I can do that on my own, but it's nice connectivity. We get together at these conferences a few times a year with 80 of the top industrial guys from and gals from Colliers, and we go tour reports together and you trade knowledge and just get that community that I really appreciate and can't imagine. And I guess you can do that through SIOR, so there's all kinds of arguments, but also if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Sure. And
I'm happy, man. So, but always envious of you, entrepreneurs that go start your own deal. I think it's so cool. So you started with a few teammates.
No, I just left solo. Went solo. Yeah.
What was your goal? Like, go get a listing?
That's a good.
Did you bring some listings with you?
I've said it before that, like, if we're trying to look for a highlight film from my first 2 years, there weren't many clips to really pick from. But yeah, I just went. What I did was I went on a frenzy of going to meet people. Just a frenzy. And I created a spreadsheet pretty quickly and I broke it down into capital, clients, and colleagues. And just listed the people I was meeting, like which of those three categories did they fall into. And what's fascinating is to look at our business today, how much of our business today ties to those first 60 days when I had nothing to do and was just trying to keep myself busy so I didn't make my wife paranoid that I had nothing to do. And I was just going to see people.
Made the list.
Yeah.
Did you record all of the meetings that you had?
I'm sure I have it recorded. I mean, I've got a good calendar system and I have that spreadsheet that shows like who I was meeting with and what category they were in.
I have a similar spreadsheet to when I really got a plan in place. It required some coaching after years of doing commercial real estate to really before I took my business to where it is today. But it was an Excel spreadsheet with like 50 names on it really. And if you go look at that list, that's like the foundation of my entire business today. So the Excel spreadsheet model works wonders.
Keep it simple.
You just got to use it.
Yeah, yeah.
I tell people all the time, you can have my database and all the cell phone numbers, all my clients, because there's probably about 0.5% of people out there that will actually go pick up a phone and call them persistently enough to ever get their attention. Like, that's my philosophy.
I mean, I've learned that doing tenant rep business where, you know, we'll work on a deal that's a size that hits the big deal report, if you will, and just the lack of calls we get from leasing agents about the deal. It's like people feel like having the information is what matters, and I feel like what matters is taking action on the information.
Right. Yeah. I like that. I might have to put that in the show notes as a quote.
Show notes.
Love it. What your business, you lease office space, but you do tenant rep. What would you say your business is in, you know, to somebody that said, what does AltCo do?
We arrange transactions for landlords or tenants. We help them buy, sell, lease property.
Do you ever think of getting on the principal side?
Yeah, I do. We do a lot of investing and we need to, you know, I thought a lot about originating our own investments, but at this point we've just kept it where we're a service business and enjoying doing that with our clients.
Yeah. That's cool. What advice would you give to your younger self?
Try harder.
Yeah.
That's it.
I feel like you've tried so hard.
I think you can create an image of trying hard. I think we all know that. I think what's fascinating to consider is what's your potential effort and call it 100%. Like how much of it do you really realize over the course of the year, over the course of a day, over the course of an hour? That's what I do is I try to get, I bet I'm a 70%.
That's really good, probably.
I'm maybe up 60%. Yeah. I don't know, but I could do a lot more. And I know when I was younger, I could have as well.
Have you read Can't Hurt Me?
No.
David Goggins, I think that's the name of his book. No. It's all about that, basically, like the potential for what humans can do.
Yeah.
Versus, and he's done like all these crazy like Ironmans and 100-mile races through the desert.
I think Elon Musk is like 90%. I feel like he's just frenzied, you know?
Yeah. It's funny you're talking about walking fast. I'm naturally a fast walker. And one of the coaches I work with, she said, I want you to try something. Stop walking so fast and just catch yourself. And it's like a consciousness exercise more than anything else. So, and I'm in the airports all the time, just like, go, 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 go. And I started now just catching myself and then walking slow. And like walking in slow motion, and then you just take in everything in the environment around you. And it's a pretty cool little thing to do sometimes. So I forgot to mention that because I'm a fast walking guy, and she's like, walk slower. Just make eye contact with people and smile and see joy that brings you.
Yeah.
Like you're gonna make your flight. I mean, if you're gonna miss the flight by 5 seconds, sure, run, but like most of the time you're gonna be there 20 minutes early. So what are you in such a hurry for? And also some of these things like the try harder and do, I've had that mentality a lot. Like I want to do Ironmans and do all of this stuff and play college football. And, but there's something to be said also about taking the foot off the gas sometimes and just like enjoying, right?
Yeah. But like, even to that point, I feel like, so I've picked up golf in the past 6 or 8 months and playing a lot of golf and trying to get better at that. And I've realized that
you're playing a lot of golf.
I know.
Impressive.
Thank you. It's a sport where I'm, like you're suggesting, I'm used to playing sports where I could exert myself harder. I could go faster. I could run harder. And that worked. And in golf, like that level of, that approach doesn't work. And so it's been interesting to be in a different sport where I kind of have to be more mindful of other things that matter.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yoga for me is that. So I think that changed me. And I stopped doing the hardcore endurance stuff that I was and got into yoga. And I still feel some of the stuff from that, but it's also just like required patience and moving slow and holding in like an uncomfortable position for long periods of time. So it's kind of like that. Golf is like, seems more relaxing though. Yoga is kind of painful still. Right. I'm still a little bit of a masochist. Okay, what is your greatest failure?
Man, I have lots of them. I don't feel like I have like a single just like disaster. Man, that was a real, I don't know. I did look at some of these questions beforehand, I promise. This was probably the one I grappled with the most in terms of like, what would I answer with?
Everyone says it's a hard question.
What's interesting is like, I've always thought about journaling and how you might journal if no one ever was going to review it but you. If you could be totally honest with yourself about things, and maybe you feel like you can do that.
That's what that is right there.
Yeah. I think I probably haven't been quite that honest with myself. I'd say, I just look recently, I feel like I'm failing inside my family with just key relational things with my kids and perhaps my wife, all correctable, but like really need to get it right where we have more strife than we'd like to have at the moment.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I've never been one to focus on failure and like what's not working well and, you know, beating myself up. Sometimes I call that loser talk, but I don't mean to not be reflective. And I know that, you know, as of this morning, like Lori and I are both like, hey, here's some things that aren't working out the best in our family, and we need to address them quickly to make sure everyone's, you know, redirected in a path that's as productive as possible because the time's short.
Yeah. It's a two-part question. It's like, what positive thing did that trigger? And like your consciousness around that inevitably is going to trigger better relationships than it would if you weren't thinking about like where, I mean, you can improve.
I hope that's the case.
I'm listening to your, I need to like talk to your father about parenting, it sounds like, and like get some, I want him, I just want a copy of that letter because I'm, and like
I'll
this,
send it to you. It's
the
great.
Schoolwork, I'm bad at pushing. I don't feel like I do a good enough job, and it's kind of tricky being a single dad half the time, but like helping with homework or like the grades are not probably in an ideal world. I'd love it if my daughter made straight A's, and she is pretty close to it, but I know like I could do better at helping establish some type of like, this is important, but also not be just like an asshole about it too. Do you know what I mean?
Sounds that's my like, wife. That's, that was the theme of my wife's message to me today.
Really?
To quit being that in our family. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But my dad's letter, I'll send it to you, but he writes a 2-page essay, and then there's 2 more pages after that of like bullet points. But the 2-page essay, he's explaining that the key to being a good parent is to be a good person. And he explains that being a good person is a spiritual assessment. And again, it's 2 pages, but the summary is he says that you're a good person when you're able to control your self-centeredness. And if you can control your self-centeredness, you will be a good parent.
Wow.
Yeah. But you'll like the essay. Good.
I like the simplicity of that. It's very true. Wow. Thanks for sharing all that. What's your morning ritual?
I'm not really a ritual guy. My mornings are different.
Yeah.
They're different. I mean, it can range from waking up before my family is up, you know, scurrying out to my golf course south of downtown and, you know, playing a quick 9 holes, grabbing a shower, and then going to work, which is what I did today. I actually had an 8 o'clock call today on Zoom.
Solo?
I love to play solo, just 9 holes.
Yeah.
With golf, I like the hospitality aspect of it where I say, hey, you and 2 brothers, let's all play. I'm hosting. We're going to play around and have dinner or have lunch. So I like that part. So I do play with people a lot, but I play a lot by myself.
You're like breaking 100, it seems like, from Instagram.
I can score between like 91 to, I can also shoot 115 still. So I'm not claiming
that's fun, breaking 100. I used to play. I quit like 15 years ago or something. I tried to play it first and then I just wasn't for me.
Yeah.
Might be again. I feel drawn to it sometimes just going out there on the beautiful golf course. So let's see. What's your favorite hotel?
That's a good one. I have a couple. I love the Battery Hotel in San Francisco. If you can imagine Park House here in Dallas, the social club, imagine that same social club with 1 more floor and 12 really nice hotel rooms. That's the Battery in San Francisco.
That's cool.
It's completely cool. I like Crosby Street Hotel in New York City. That was recommended to me by Benji Holmesy, who's the former Zaza president and the owner of Duro Hospitality, the restaurant group here in town. He told me to go there one time. He actually recommended both of those hotels, and they're actually 2 of my favorites. And my third favorite would be Letitia in Paris, which is in the 6th, and it's just an incredible hotel. It's just really nice.
I am going to put all those in the show notes so anyone can just go look and
those
click
are good,
on
those
them.
Are good ones.
But I've never stayed at any of those.
They're great.
So sounds great. I travel so much. I love asking that question and trying to find.
What's your favorite hotels?
Oh, I like.
You seem like more of a like an exotic beach kind of place.
Yeah, I think I asked myself all of these questions in the second episode of this podcast, and I said Tulum in Tulum. Mm-hmm. So I like, when I travel for work, I like to stay. I mean, I always stay at Bonvoy's just because it pays for my family vacations by doing that. So I always fly American Airlines. I always stay Bonvoy hotels and I rack up points.
And so
and
Bonvoy,
status.
You're knowing like, hey, I'm going to have a pretty new hotel. The vibe's going to be pretty cool.
Almost every city, there's great hotels. Okay. And that includes like W hotels. I just stayed at the W in Aspen and used points. So it was like a free stay going there. Wow. There's like all these, so it's W, the Ritz-Carlton, St. Regis, lots of good, like solid bougie places. And when
what's your definition of bougie?
That is, I just like mean like fancy.
I think bougie also has like a negative connotation with younger people. Like when my high school kids are saying bougie, I think they're making fun of us.
It can, but I make fun of myself kind of when I say it. Okay, so it's a little like self-deprecating.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it's like extremely high levels of service, extremely high quality food, comfortable beds, and like those in great atmospheres, smells nice. Like, I mean, when I live on the road, that has become important to me.
Mm-hmm.
When I played in my band for a living, I lived on the road and I slept in a van oftentimes or on a random person's couch or floor, and occasionally got a hotel room where we would share like a Motel 6 with three guys in one room. So once I could afford to do this, and I don't know if like some type of financial advisor would tell me that I definitely couldn't afford it when I started doing it, but I started flying first class and staying at nice hotels.
I've noticed you fly first class.
Yeah, always. Because I fly almost every week, and I tried to cut my expenses and not do it. And then I just get stuck in coach, and I don't like being in coach. Like, my shoulders don't fit in the seats. Uh-huh. And I'll fly in coach with my two kids if we're going somewhere, of course. Like, that's no big deal. But it's just like part of the lifestyle that I guess if I'm going to continue living this way, it's the only way it's sustainable for me is to have these niceties, I guess. So, moving on, let's see. What's your favorite restaurant? You eat at a lot of restaurants.
Yeah, I'm
a... You eat at more restaurants than I do, probably.
At least locally.
Yeah.
God, I have a lot of favorites. I love Hillstone. I love Parigi.
George Billingsley said both of those restaurants, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, he did.
Huh.
And I love Hillstone. I was actually trying to go there this week. I love the Caesar salad, actually.
Really?
Is fantastic. The ribs.
I love the ribs.
The ribs are so good. What do you get?
You know what's funny to me about...
Shrimp cocktail?
No, I don't. I get the ribs. But what's funny to me about Hillstone is to think about the name change that happened after the Obamacare law got passed. And like, as part of that law, there was legislation that required any restaurant with... I may be wrong on the numbers, but if you had more than 20 of the restaurant, you had to list the calories on the menu. And so suddenly Houston's goes from Houston's to multiple concepts. Can you imagine what our reaction might be if we learned that the ribs have 3,800 calories at Hillstone?
No, I don't want to know.
They got to have a ton, right?
I mean, yeah. At least I
like not knowing.
I'd rather have barbecue sauce than like bread or something. Like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but the fries and the coleslaw.
Yeah. All those things like don't bother me as much as if I were to eat like a cheeseburger or something. And
you don't like cheeseburger?
I don't like bread. I look at bread as the enemy. And I've been on this fitness journey for a few years, and I've lost a lot of weight. And one of the things I've done is train myself to basically eat bread like it is a special occasion. So if I get a really good burger, I'll take a bite. And then I'll throw the bread away. And so I get to enjoy that first bite.
Wow.
And then, like tortillas are some of my favorite things, but I just treat it with like a respectful moment when I'm eating the bread. But I've done like the Dexcom and measured my blood sugar over the course of weeks and seen how different carbs affect my body. And like the barbecue sauce has a lot of sugar in it and will spike my blood sugar, but it doesn't stay as spiked for as long as it does with bread.
So, oh, wow.
And then once I saw that actual data come back on this constant glucose monitors, what it is, CGM, then I just started feeling actually like, if I eat a lot of bread, I feel really tired after dinner. Mm. And it's because your blood sugar's spiked up for so long.
Right.
But anyway, interesting. I've not been to Parigi, so I...
Do you know where it is?
No. I mean, George told me it's like Preston and Royal or something.
No. That's New Haas, which is one of my favorite places. But Parigi is over there on Oak Lawn near Cedar Springs.
Okay.
I think you'd like it a lot.
Yeah.
It's got a cool vibe.
I got to try it. I got a free weekend this weekend to go eat some dinner, so might go check it out.
No bread, though.
No bread. Maybe one bite. What's a book that's worth talking about?
Four Agreements.
That's what book I said. And you told me about that book.
Oh my gosh. I knew I told you about that, but I'm pleased to know that you think that highly of it.
Oh yeah. I have like 50 copies of it here in my house.
I have another friend who says hundreds in his trunk of his car and just hands them out to people when he ends up talking about it.
That's what I do. It might have been me.
No, it's another friend.
Really? Another friend does it. No, I've done it. I'll bring them on planes with me and just whoever I'm sitting next to, if we happen to have a conversation, I'll give them a copy of the Four Agreements. Recently, I was on a plane with a music agent from LA and we were coming home from Tulum. And I think he's Kid Cudi's agent and Nicki Minaj's agent. But we started talking. He's into self-help books. And I had it right there and gave him the Four Agreements. That was one of the last times I did that.
But what do you like about the book?
I like to reread it. I like that whenever something goes wrong in my life, I can probably look back to the Four Agreements and I can identify that's one of those things that's making this thing go wrong, and then it's easy to fix. So it's a solve-all for every problem in life.
Has there ever been a problem that didn't trace to one of the four that you've... To me, it's always one of the four.
It always is. And sometimes it's like, it's easy. It's like, sure, you know it, but can you practice it? Sure. Not take something personally, that's one of them. And that's hard sometimes, but then I know all I'm doing by taking this personally is torturing myself right now. And it's all just being created by myself, my reaction to this. So,
right, so it's number one, be impeccable with your word. Two, take nothing personally. Three, make no assumptions. Four, try your best.
I think
that's great. I think it's really good.
I love just the way it's written too.
What do you think about
kind of mystical?
Yeah, so I didn't like that part.
Yeah, I like
the first half of the book. But I understood, having read the entirety of the book, that I had to read the first part of the book to understand the second part. To me, the first part is kind of his theology.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, if you notice, I have pictures of myself with Peruvian shamans hanging on my wall over there.
I did notice that. I see that.
I'm into all of this stuff. Great. So, and probably not.
Did I point you in that direction?
Yeah, you actually did. God. You did. You sent me on this vision quest to the Amazon. Thanks. I know it was unintentional.
That's unbelievable.
That book really changed my life. So what's your favorite quote or a quote you'd like to share?
Oh, I don't know if I have a favorite quote, but the quote that I know the best is the persistence quote by Calvin Coolidge.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Yeah, that's a good one. We had to memorize that in the fraternity. And we had to chant it, it seems like, almost all day for a semester. But it's just such a great quote.
Can you quote the whole thing?
I probably can. It's a long one. But the essence of it is that there's lots of things you can be. You can be educated. You can be privileged, you can be all sorts of things, but none of that matters if you're not also persistent. And in fact, you don't have to have those things at all if you're persistent.
That's right. Yeah.
Slogan, press on, has solved, and always will solve the problems of the human race.
You can watch that happen on repeat in our business.
Yeah, totally.
For sure. Mm-hmm. And it's so critical. They gave it to us when I started at Robert Lynn after my music hiatus, and they have a great training program there. And I remember Craig Jones was leading the training exercise and they handed out laminated versions of that quote. It's still at my Collier's office downtown. It's uptown, but thumbtacked to the wall, and it's been there for 17 years. So great quote. We'll put that quote in the show notes. I always start show notes with the quote.
Cool.
Okay. What song do you want to share today? I just put that in the show notes so people can go check that out.
Golly,
I'd love to play it.
I don't consider myself that musical, but I'll say my son is playing the violin and I'm learning to really enjoy music just from his interest.
Yeah.
My wife has a good expertise in lots of things. One of them is music. So it's fun to hear those two talk about things that I've never really heard discussed. So I can't tell you the name of the song, but I was at his concert and they played the coolest, this is a sixth grade orchestra, but they played a song that was really cool that I can imagine as they get more skilled and more proficient at their orchestra abilities will be a really powerful song to listen to, but I don't know the name of the song.
That sounds like a great song.
Because let me tell you, it was an awesome song.
I'm going to trust you on that.
Yeah, that's true.
So You can find the title to that song once again in the show notes.
I'll send it to you for your show notes.
Okay. How many times? Drink every time I say show notes, everyone. Okay. What about a charity or cause that you'd like to talk about? I imagine you should sit on lots of boards and whatnot and support lots of charitable causes, but do you have a favorite or a couple you'd like to mention?
I don't have a couple, but I think the one that to me has been the most interesting to be part of the past couple of years is the Human Impact, which is a group that's trying to address homelessness in our city.
Did Sochi just go to something with that?
She did,
I think
yeah,
she did.
Yeah,
she was telling me about that.
Yeah, just getting to know the people that run that group and the people that work there and seeing their work in the streets, you just realize like how hard it is to try to help people get off the streets. And also it's made me really evaluate when we say we want to address homelessness, like what does that really mean? I think for some people it means we just don't want to see it. Just get it out of my face, get it out of me. It's a blight on the city. I think it's important to try to figure out like, how do you help people who are in that spot, like move out of that spot? Because one thing I realized in my life is that three or four years ago is that the more you were like me, the more I wanted to help you. Like if you were a young kid from SMU who also was a Fiji, you know, I was just dying to help that guy. And what I also realized is that so long as you could reach me, I was probably willing to help you. If you could email me or call me, I would help.
Yeah.
But like you think about that person on the street sometimes, they have no ability to reach, you know, you or me. And so it's just kind of fascinating that in our society, like we'll help people until they get to this place where they most need the help. Like once you get to the streets and you can't really reach folks, that's the person who needs the help the most. But it seems like it's the person we tend to help the least.
Yeah.
So I've enjoyed my work with the Human Impact.
Yeah, that's cool. I'll have to go check out an event.
Yeah, you'd like it. You'd like to go walk the streets and to see how they interact with people and try to build relationships. It's pretty fascinating.
Being through like the addiction gambit before, like some of that stuff, thankfully, like I never went there to that degree, but a lot of people that I met or family members of people that I met, like the drugs and alcohol or addiction mm-hmm. can like take people to this point where it becomes so difficult to like, to help them. And like, and sometimes it's just like, you gotta help yourself to escape that type of thing. And I mean, they have like Al-Anon set up. I don't know if you've heard of that, but Al-Anon is like for family members and relatives of alcoholics or addicts about basically how taxing it is on them to try to save somebody that they care about, like their son or sister or whatever. And just like how tough that is emotionally and how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Because, and then a lot of that I know just from going to AA meetings many a times, like there's a lot of people in AA meetings, they were homeless and hooked on crack and getting drunk all the time or whatever. And then they had this moment of clarity and changed. And then they're like CEO of a company and going to AA meetings and helping others. But gosh, it's seeing that through that world, you meet a lot of people that have lived home in the homeless environment that are on the other side of it. But mm-hmm. I haven't really spent as much time doing that. And I've been to homeless shelters and volunteered before, but I'll have to check out one of their events.
Yeah, that's good.
Thanks for sharing.
Sure.
If you had $100 million in a briefcase, it'd be a big briefcase. But what would you invest it in if you had to pick one thing? I'd say just one asset class of sorts, or if there's just one piece of jewelry that you're thinking about, you can say that too. But if that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. I've just never thought about, I've always thought about like breaking money up into buckets.
And doing diversifying it?
Yeah, not like, nah. You're saying that there's no choice.
No, that'd be like, that's what, yeah.
I'd probably buy a painting.
Ooh. Wait. Like
what you're telling me is like, I have to go for broke. with Picasso? My briefcase.
Well, you could buy, you could buy like a portfolio of office buildings or something. Like,
I'd rather have a painting.
Yeah. You'd buy a Monet.
Yeah.
Boom. I love it. I think that's a good investment.
It's better than having it in a briefcase.
Yeah. What would you put it?
I don't know.
You'd have to build some type of case for it.
I'm probably scared of my mind. I don't know what. I don't know. Hell, I'll just put it on my wall. Who cares?
Yeah.
It was found money anyway.
Oh, gosh. I can only imagine. Just put that right there in the office. Put it in the lobby of the hallway. Okay. What's number one thing on your 2023 bucket list?
I want to have a 12 handicap in golf.
I knew you were going to say golf. What does 12 handicap mean for those that don't know, like me?
I don't really know either. I know that right now I'm 22.7, and I know that 12/31/22 I was 36. And I know that like going from 36 to 22 is much easier than going from 22 to 12. But basically what it means is it's a gauge of your consistency of play. And I can go shoot 95, or I shot 98 yesterday, and I can play with someone who shoots 84, and we can have a lot of the same shots through that round, but the difference between his 84 and my 98 is his consistency is just better than my ability. So I'm missing more shots, costing myself more strokes. That's the way I kind of think about handicap.
Yeah. That's why I quit playing golf. It's my inconsistency. Chasing balls, like trying to find balls in the rough. Man, thanks for your time today.
I enjoyed it.
That's what I got.
Thanks for having me.
We clocked in at 55 minutes. You thought it would be 30.
I knew I wouldn't go very long.
Yeah, but that's perfect. How do our listeners find you?
Just Google. I'm easily found on Google.
Love that.
Yeah.
Google, John Altshuler. And we'll put in the show notes. Alt Co. Is it Alt Plus Co. or is it Alt Co.?
Well, it's whatever you want. It's Altshuler and Company, and we abbreviate it to Alt Co.
I love the branding.
Thank you.
What is it? Slant Marketing?
Slant Partners.
Slant Partners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You do a good job.
Very good. Did they do this? Did the team there also do the marketing at Stream that we were talking about?
They did Tommy Gunn.
Tommy Gunn. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Slant Partners. We'll put that in there too. All right. Thanks, brother.
It's fun.
All right. Peace.
Good work.
Thanks everybody for tuning in to this episode of Truckin' On. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, don't be shy. Please like, share, leave a 5-star review so that we can keep doing what we're doing. Stay safe out there on the road. Keep on trucking. Adios.